Welcome to Independent Truths with Scott Atlas, brought to you by the Independent Institute, my show that tries to bring a uniquely rational perspective to important and controversial issues facing America today. Today's guest is my friend Victor Davis Hanson. Victor is a world-renowned scholar of classics and military history. He is the Martin and Ily Anderson Senior Fellow at Hoover Institution and has several other professorial appointments, including Hillsdale College and Pepperdine University. He's a prolific author and perhaps one of today's most important voices on culture and politics in the United States. Today, Victor and I have a conversation about today's America and its future as a peaceful yet diverse society, as we see so much hatred culminating in violence based on political disagreements. And we'll hear his perspective on the Trump era to date. Thanks for joining us and stay tuned. Hello, Victor. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
We have a lot to talk about, as you know. I'm going to start with a big question. And the big question is, are we in a war? Is this country in a civil war? And I'm asking that to also get your historical sort of idea of how this current state of division, of hatred, and now political violence compares with any other historical precedent.
Yeah, I'd say we're in a Cold War, that the country is dividing ideologically, and now it's starting to divide, as you know, Scott, geographically. 4 million people are leaving blue states every year, and red states are getting redder, and blue states are getting bluer. But more importantly, in that dialectic, the blue state model doesn't work. So the migration is always one way, and within the next census, the Republicans may get 10 or 12 new seats. That's important because the blue people are getting exasperated. They don't have political power right now in the Senate, House, White House, or Supreme Court. They're on the wrong side of 30-70 issues, and they're in debt, they have high crime, and people don't want to live there. So they're having exoduses, and that's not only dividing the country geographically and ideologically, but they're getting desperate, and they're getting angry. And I think that's being expressed. As far as, I'm worried, because that's a good question, you know. Before Caesar crossed the Rubicon in 49 BC, there had been 50 years, 60 years of violence. Claudius and Milo, Sulla, Marius, in the Roman Republic, but it always came back. And then finally, from 49 to 31, there was 18 years of just bloodshed. Same thing if you look at this country around 1850 to 1861, whether it was Bleeding Kansas or John Brown's raid or the Missouri Compromise even earlier, everybody knew the problem was getting unsolvable and the extremists were taking over, mostly on the southern side, but not all. There were the abolitionists that didn't want to give. And then Weimar in Germany was another good, maybe the best example, though, was Russia around 1900. Between that and 1917, that was a war where moderates wanted to have a constitutional republic with the czar kept as a monarch on the British model. And then Kerensky, who was a socialist, was more radical. And Lenin had no support, but the Bolsheviks were able to hijack that. And that 17-year-old tension because of World War I and the losses led to the Bolshevik Revolution, and what followed under Stalin was 20 million killed. So there's a lot of precedent that you don't want these Cold War tensions to accelerate to violence, and yet we're seeing that.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the violence, particularly. I think it's, you know, there's this obvious sort of statement repeated that the violence is generated by the inflammatory language of the media, of social media, of political leaders. And yes, there's an argument put forward by the left that it's stemming from the right, but I think that sort of defies the stuff we see with our eyes, as we know. And that sort of violence is too, I think there's two things to discuss here. Number one is the role of the media, the amplification that we see of really inflammatory language from political leaders, from people like Joe Biden's, speech in Philadelphia in 2022, yeah, where he said that Trump is a threat to the very fundamental existence of the United States, and that kind of more direct calls for violence, really, for thuggish behavior by people like Maxine Waters, who said, yeah, get in their face,
yeah,
you know, don't let them, the conservatives, be really treated peacefully. And of course, the statement is often made that the media is playing a role, but it's actually quantifiable. And I outlined this in a paper I wrote recently in Real Clear Politics, that there's actually numbers, that there's a general nuance of a characterization of everyone on the right as being extreme or far right versus the ones on the left. They're not called extreme or far left. That's really orders of magnitude more frequent by all the media, 5-1, but also MSNBC, 18-1, PBS, 42-1, linking the words extreme with the right side, but yes, never with the left side. That's sort of the general, I think that's very inflammatory. But then this idea that Trump and all conservatives and MAGA is a, quote, threat to democracy or fascistic. What is your perception, I'm sure, is that that happens, but I wonder, is that important? How important is it? Have we ever seen something like this?
We saw a little bit in the last years of George Bush, when people like John Glenn, for example, called him a Nazi. Angela Merkel did too, but not like this. And this is new. This is new because it's not, I mean, you're right about the language. If you're a left-wing terrorist, you're called a militant. If you're a right-wing criminal, you're called a terrorist. And that's definable. And you were right to mention Joe Biden. Remember, he said to a bunch of donors, it's time to put a bullseye on the back of Donald Trump. He said that just 30 days before he was almost killed. And he had that sort of, you mentioned that speech he gave. It was kind of like Phantom of the Opera with the red background, and he yelled about fascists, semi-fascists, and ultra-MAGA. So they were trying to create an image that the people that were around Trump, we saw that with the January 6th people, that they were armed insurrectionaries and dangerous and had to be put down. And the term fascist, what it does is it creates a climate, and then people on the left feel, well, the general status of law enforcement with critical legal theory, critical race theory, that Soros DA period, is you're not really going to have to pay a price. Because if you're DeCarlos Brown, if you want to slit somebody's throat, you look at your record, 14 felonies, he was let out. So he thinks, whatever I do, even this, they're not going to do anything to me. And the other thing is, the people think when they commit a political, and by the way, Tyler Robinson said in his exchange with his trans lover, I think I was going to live to old age, meaning I was going to get away with this. He really did think, and he was just saying, I only made one mistake. I left my gun there. So there was a sense that either law enforcement wouldn't go after you, or, and there was good reason for that, given Alvin Bragg and all these people letting criminals go. So we lowered the threshold of deterrence, and that encouraged people. The second incentive was, well, if I'm Luigi Mangione and I murder the CEO of a healthcare, or I'm Sarnoff and I'm really good looking, I might be on the cover of Rolling Stone, or if I'm Luigi Mangione, then Taylor Lorenz from the Washington Post might give me a really puff piece about how handsome I am. And so there was a sense that on the left, if you killed a Donald Trump, like Crooks thought, or you killed Elon Musk, as people had threatened, or you kill a CEO, or you bomb a bunch of bourgeoisie, then the left will put you in the pantheon of heroes. They really did believe that. And Tyler Robinson, I think, thought, I'm not going to get caught, but if it leaks out that I got rid of Charlie Kirk, I'll be pretty famous. And so we lowered the sense of deterrence in two different ways, and we brought out of the woodwork these people with a propensity. And the media, you mentioned, when you look at Jimmy Kimmel, he was just reflecting, when he said it was a MAGA kill, he was just reflecting what the media was saying. And on CNN and MSNBC, they openly said that there was no evidence. You know, it's worse than that, Scott. I wrote an article on the narratives of Tyler Robinson. The first narrative, as you remember, was we don't know his motive. He's mentally ill, whoever this guy is. The second motive was, well, he may have had left-wing tendency, but his parents voted for Trump, so it's both sides. And then the third one was, well, it's Trump's fault. Trump, and that was, he ginned it up. Obama said that, and he ginned it up. And then that didn't work. And then the fourth one was, well, it was a love story. That was on CNN, I think. Two or three people said that ABC reporter said it was endearing. They called him my love, as if they were Elizabethan, you know, court poets talking to each other. It was a love story about transgenderism. It really, they were just so emotional, they went over the edge. And then the final one, and then there was, well, okay, it was a MAGA person. But the final one that we're in now on the left is, yeah, we did it. What are you going to do about it? This is the Jasmine Crockett, AOC, Ilhan Omar, New Republic. This guy is a Nazi, Charlie Kirk. He deserved what he got. I mean, I'm not happy he got killed, but I'm happy that we stopped his fascism. That's where the left is now.
Yeah, I mean, I want to support something that you know, people say, oh, it's both sides or whatever. There was a survey done within the past few months ago, that said, is it justified to murder Elon Musk or Donald Trump?
Yeah.
And the numbers I'm looking at here on my computer, 50.2% of people, this is a Rutgers University study, 50.2% of Democrats said it's justifiable to kill Musk. 56% said it's justifiable to kill Trump. 14% of Republicans said it's justifiable to kill Musk. And the 20% said, this is right of center versus left of center, not Democrat and Republican. Right of center, 20% said it's justifiable to kill Trump. But, you know, in my way of thinking, you know, between 10 and 15% or so is always an answer on every survey. But, you know, when you get more than half of leftists, left of center people in the United States, more than half saying it's justified to murder Elon Musk and Donald Trump. That's not the same as both sides. So, you know, we keep hearing this is just another media lie perpetrated on the public as a sort of propaganda tool. This is false reporting. In this kind of stuff, we had a politicized divided society in the 60s. Okay, you know, we were little kids then. I wasn't very conscious of what was going on. But that kind of politicized, divisive country, I think this is far worse than that. What do you think?
Yeah, I do. Part of it is social media. In those days, if you wanted to comment on the murder of King or RFK, you wrote a letter to the editor. I mean, that was the only way you could express your... And even then, they wouldn't publish it. So people who were commenting that they were happy that somebody, say, in 68 got murdered, there wasn't really an outlet. Today, you can go on social media, and you can either disguise your identity or not, and you can say all you want without any consequences, and you get clicks from it. So there's incentives to be more and more radical and get and be known. And there's no downside on it. There's no social shame to it. There's no deterrence, nothing. And so that makes a big difference. It's good. I think it's good to remember that what brought the 60s craziness to an end was the 72 landslide by Richard Nixon, when the party said, we don't want Humphrey anymore, the Democrats. We don't want JFK. We want to go hard left with McGovern. We want to, you know, have that convention, and we're going to get all of this. That was the first time they talked about gay marriage. They talked about reparations, and they got slaughtered. And even with Watergate, if you take 72 all the way to 88, they had 20 years of Republican rule, except for the four-year Carter hiatus, and the Clinton 8 years. And you look at Clinton's 8 years, and he was, if you look at Clinton said 92 and 96, it's pretty much what Trump said: close the border, balance the budget, school uniforms. So what I'm getting at is, what destroyed the left-wing cultural revolution of the 60s was people repudiated it for 20 or 25 years at the polls. There was that little Carter hiatus. But if you look at, you know, you had 8 years of Nixon Ford, and then you had 12 years of Reagan Bush. That was 20 years, and you only had 4 years of Carter in between. And then when you had Clinton, it was a continuum of 28 years. So the left just said, you know what, nobody wants us, we have no power, and they went into hibernation. And then they came out with Barack Obama. And I really do blame him for a lot, because until he came to be president, we didn't talk about race in the way we do now, for example, or politics. He was the one that really mainstreamed going over to Turkey and apologizing for all of our sins, or saying that we were not especially exceptional. Or he was the one, by the way, you mentioned Maxine Waters. He was the first to take that line from David Mamet in The Untouchables. He said, if they have a knife, we bring a gun to a knife fight. And then he also said, get in their faces, get in their faces. He said, I want you all to go and get in their faces. And then we had the beer summit. And then we had the apology tour. And then we had Trayvon, so he really polarized the country. He tried to do it on racial lines, but he did it also on ideological lines. He brought back the McGovern failed left, and he mainstreamed it. And that, after Obama, there was no room for people, moderate Democrats anymore. They were gone. And then Biden was not a president. He was a waxen effigy for the Obama third term. So, yeah, I think that's where we are right now. And the only way to stop it is if Donald Trump has a successful 4 years, and his successor, whether Vance or Rubio, has another 8 years, you can stop it. But that's how it stopped the first time.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like rust. It's like rust. It always comes back.
Right. It's also a different era and more difficult now, because the media is so one-sided. Because the media, it may have been one-sided when we were kids with the few media outlets that there were, but I have a feeling it was more objective. Now, maybe I'm naive.
No, you were right. No,
but
it was.
Here, yeah, I mean, we have a media that is a campaign and propaganda tool. It's really, you know, there's analogies, in my view, to Nazi Germany. And I'm not a historian, and you, of course, are. But there's so many parallels. And one is the value and strength and effectiveness of propaganda. It's Goebbels who had this very famous quote. He was the head of the Nazi propaganda machine. And he said, if you repeat something that's false often enough, it becomes true. But there's a second part of his statement, which is that, and then you start believing it yourself. And so here I'm making the point that I don't think the left is lying anymore. I think they are convinced of what they say. I'm not on the camp that says, oh, they're just lying. I think they are so tied up in their own propaganda and repetition that Trump is a fascist, that the conservative side is the end of democracy, all these things. They've said it so often that I'm actually thinking they believe it. And
no,
that's
they do
why
believe it.
It's impossible to change them.
No, the only way you can't change them, Charlie Kirk proved that. He was trying to do that peacefully, and they killed him. And they'll probably try to kill somebody else like him who does that. The reason I'm so pessimistic about that, I look at the reaction to his death. And then the final narrative after they tried six or seven of them was, okay, he was a fascist. He got killed. I'm sad about his family. I don't care because we got rid of a fascist. That's what people in Congress are basically saying. They wouldn't even vote for 118 people on the Democratic Party either voted no, present, or didn't even vote about a simple little commemorative motion that said, we want to honor the life and legacy of Charlie Kirk. And that was the majority of the Democratic Party, that the people who voted no. And so, yeah, they're not going to change. And the only thing that's going to make them not an obstacle toward normality is they have to be repudiated at the polls. They have to see that this brand of hard left, neo-socialist, whatever you want to call anarchism, will destroy them politically. And that happened. It really did. And it didn't really, I mean, Nixon was not a popular candidate. He'd almost lost his initial election against Humphrey in 68. It was very close. So he won, but his reelection was just a landslide. And, you know, you had Carter barely beat Gerry Ford, then Reagan won in a landslide, and then Bush, more or less the first time, won in a landslide. That ended it. And we can do the same thing, but you're right also that the media is much more sophisticated. It's not like John Chancellor and Huntley Brinkley and Walter Cronkite kind of being an old, stuffy liberal, you know. You know, those guys were all Cold War hawks. They were anti-communists. They were liberal, naive about the great society, but they were not toxic people like you see on, you know, on MSNBC or CNN or these anchors today. And when they had debates, if you look at the Kennedy-Nixon debate, the moderators didn't get in there and try to do stuff. So it's the left. And my only comment finally on that topic is, where did it begin? I really do believe it began politically with Obama, but culturally and socially, it began with the university. And I can tell you that as a graduate student in the 70s, I had all left-wing professors, but they were all highly trained philologists. So if we were taking Greek composition or the manuscript tradition of Aeschylus, they did not interject their politics. And then when you go to have a drink with them at their home, they would kind of make fun of Nixon or something, you know what I mean? But they did not intrude. And then I think with the DEI and the idea that we were racist and we were going to lower standards and we were going to make it politicized, we're going to bring in 1.2 million students, we're going to change the university to a multi-service therapeutic center for that, counseling for this, DEI, and then two things happened. They lowered the standards to accommodate a new type of student that was not prepared for what they said was necessary to continue their prestige. And one of the reasons is they lowered standards, and then people did not have to do the same level of work. So today, if you graduate from Stanford, and I talk to people in Silicon Valley, they will tell you flat out, I would rather have a student from Texas Tech or Georgia Tech in coding than Stanford, because they're just as well trained and they don't go to HR and cause trouble. But they also will tell you that a Stanford liberal arts student cannot speak or write as well or know as much as 20 years ago. And that's because they changed the curriculum, they changed the qualifications, and that was the act of and they politicize the curriculum. But one of the things we don't talk about, when you politicize the curriculum, you add these things called studies, you know, gender studies, race studies, leisure studies, environmental studies. They're all deductive. You start with, here's where you're going to end up at the end of the semester, and here's how we're going to brainwash you. But they're very easy classes. They're not, I mean, in my field, they've abolished the Greek standard at Princeton because they said it was too exclusionary. You can be a classics major at Princeton without knowing Greek because they said Greek excludes too many people of color, et cetera, et cetera. So behind all of this indoctrination, there was a subtext that this stuff is easy. It's all going to be political. You can go get a BA. Look at AOC. She doesn't know anything. She doesn't know anything about the, and yet she's got a master's from Boston University?
And yeah,
what does that mean now? It means nothing.
I think this is something that is really sort of accepted, but not talked about enough. And that is that the university has totally changed its role. When I was in college, at least we all thought that the university was there to teach you how to use critical thinking, to socialize people in terms of interactive work, et cetera. But now it's even explicitly stated in the welcome to Stanford University to the new students. They're there to teach them to be social advocates. So that's an explicit change in the role of the universities, and I'll use the word elite universities. And then the other part is, as you're pointing out, today's professors wear their ideology on their sleeve. They are not just ideologically outspoken, they're extremists. Okay, the Stanford campus, there's analysis of the debate of the voting of Stanford postal code by Alvin Rabushka, who you know as a political scientist. And 95% of Stanford faculty in 2020 voted for Biden, 3.5% voted for Trump, yet California, one out of three people voted for Trump in that election. So Stanford and other universities are extremists. They're extreme. They're not even reflecting general population. And because of that, we see the new FIRE, F-I-R-E, data on the surveys of students. And it shows that a third of college students say violence is acceptable to suppress speech. That's almost double what it was 5 years ago. And half justify political violence.
And you know why they do that? They do it because they feel that that is what their professors want to hear. And they are very quiet if they're conservative. And they feel there's no downside. So if you're a Stanford Law School student, and Judge Duncan is visiting, and you disrupt his speech, are you going to be criticized by a Stanford law official? No, she's going to hijack the speech and insert her own little text, contextualizing your violent disruption. And then when he leaves and is forced to leave Stanford Law School, this is a circuit court judge, federal judge.
Right.
Then you're going to yell, "I hope your daughters are raped." And we know who's yelled at. We know who did that. There were no consequences at all.
None.
You know, there's no stick and there's a lot of carrots. No stick and there's a lot of
incentives.
Incentives for students to be very, very left wing. And it's easy because the more left wing you are, the more you don't have to study and the classes are dumbed down. It's like I talked to a Silicon Valley guy and he was asking me, well, according to the website, 9% of the admissions at Stanford were white males, the last after George Floyd when they dropped the SAT. 9%, 20% identified as white. I don't know if mixed race was in there or not, but he said, well, they only have three choices. They either have to make new gut courses for people who don't have an SAT score, or their GPA is not comparatively judged by the quality of their high school and they're admitted on their GPA, or they have to, within the course, dumb it down so the reading will go down, or they have to inflate the grades to 70 or 80% A's, and that's what it is now. Yale is 80% A's.
You're saying they have no choice because they've accepted students who cannot compete academically.
It's even worse than that because they had told us prior to George Floyd, Stanford, Yale, Harvard, we take 3 or 4%. And the reason we take 3 or 4%, we have such a rigorous curriculum.
3 or 4% of who?
Applicants.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So they were telling us, if you want to be a Stanford student or a Yale student, you've got to have about a 770, you know, verbal minimum. You got to have an A plus average. You got to have all AP classes. You've got to have, be a violinist or go to Africa and dig a well or something. That's what they said. Because they said that because our courses are going to be so hard for you. Only those people can complete them. And when our courses are so hard, because when we turn out our graduates, they're going to be so much better than everybody else's. They're going to be in hot demand. That was what their pretext was. And then they just destroyed it. And so they let in, they had the shell of the university, and they let these people in that, according to their own standards, they would have told you in 1990, 2010, if you said, I want to go to Stanford, and I'm from Selma High School, where I graduated, and I have an A average from Selma High School. I think 10 of us went to college out of 250 students, you know, out of Fresno County. But, you know, my SAT score is 550. They would have said, you're not going to set foot in Stanford. No way. And now, for other reasons, they took students like that, and they disguised it by not even requiring the SAT. And so they were basically lying to themselves. They said, hire our people, give us prestige, because we only let the creme of the creme, and then we made art so hard they completed it, and now they're basically saying, we still want the prestige, but our courses are so dumbed down that anybody can do them, and our graduates can't read or write very well, but you still have to hire them because they're from Stanford. And by the way, we have 16,000 graduate and undergraduates, and now we have 14,000 administrative staff. So you got to give a lot more money to us because we have about 50 centers on environmentalism and sustainability and DEI and La Raza and black this and non-white this and all of that stuff. And so that's pretty scary when you walk across campus and the statistics show you that one out of every two people you meet is an administrative staffer or an administrator.
Yeah, I mean, but I wonder if yeah, and people, I think, are under a false, I think it's a false belief that there is this move away from things. I think that in a very visible way, there is an attempt to signal a move away from that because the Trump administration has threatened things about decreasing funding or taxing endowments, or if you're violating these sorts of race-based laws, really. But so they put out statements about freedom of speech and all this. But I like to say an electronic statement about academic freedom is worth the paper it's written on, which means it's not worth anything. And no. There's something, that's all performative. That's all manipulative. And I feel a lot of it is stalling because Donald Trump is here for about two more years. And that's really it. That's the reality. We don't know what will come after that. And I want to talk about that in a second. But I want to one other thing out, which is vis-a-vis the Charlie Kirk assassination and the so-called, what I think is a manipulation of the student body. It continues after the Charlie Kirk assassination. There is not an awakening at all. And I'm talking about what I see at Stanford, and I looked into the top 20 schools. Not a single, not one top 20 college and university in the United States offered any mental health support, well-being support on campus in the aftermath of the Charlie Kirk assassination, which happened on a college campus while he was speaking to the student body. Yet most of them had extensive so-called wellness and mental health support for their left-favored crises, like when George Floyd died.
How about when Donald Trump was elected?
Right.
Remember
both of those.
Chocolate chip cookies and milk at tables for distraught students in 2017.
Yeah, when you saw the fact, I live in the faculty area of Stanford University, and when George Floyd died, most of the faculty went to the quad and they had a kneel down ceremony.
I remember.
And
that.
In fact, my neighbors across the street said to me, "Aren't you going to the ceremony, the George Floyd ceremony, where everyone on campus knelt down?" Yet there was not a single word of recognizing that Charlie Kirk, who actively had only one power, and that was engaging in civil discussion. He had no power. He was not, you couldn't say he was an authoritarian. I mean, I don't even know what they're talking about. He was literally speaking with students, and yet the student body was totally abandoned by the university.
No, it was. I did his show on the 25th of August, and afterwards he wanted to talk. And we talked just like you and I are, but it was off air after the show for 30 minutes. And after that, I said to myself, I know now why they hate this guy. Because what he was explaining was, he was very excited because he was getting into questions of why young people are not marrying, you know, why the fertility rate is going down, why they can't buy a home, why there's economic, they're failing, why they get these worthless degrees and have all this debt, and they're told now they're somebody when somebody is somebody who can get married, have kids, and have a home, and, you know, have some kind of transcendent belief. And yet they can't do that. And yet they're told that they're educated. But anyway, in the process of these discussion we had, he said basically that he was a counter-revolutionary like Trump. But what he was trying to do is teach naturally rebellious students. He said, you know, when you're 16, 18, 18, 25, you're always going to question authority. But what the left hates is when you tell students that the authority is the left. They are the ones that set the rules. They are the ones that did this to you, not the right. They run the corporation. They run the media. They run foundations. They run popular culture. They run sports. They run the universities at K through 12. So he said, once I set that out, that their anger at society is really anger at the left-wing project because they control everything. They may not
right.
have. Then they get excited because they see themselves as sort of 60s revolutionaries, right? And they're challenging the man, but the man is left wing. And when the left hears that he's on campus and he's getting greater resonance with people to be naturally rebellious, they think, wow, they're supposed to be rebellious, but they're supposed to be rebellious against the CEOs of healthcare or something. And here Charlie Kirk is telling them that our policies on crime, our policies on housing, economics, fuel, the border, foreign policy is making their life miserable. And it's making their life miserable by a bunch of elites who are never subject to the consequences of their own ideology.
Right.
That was a radical message he had.
Absolutely. It's very insightful. But I like to think that, in a bigger picture, why was Charlie Kirk devoting his life to engaging Gen Z in these debates? Because what was the purpose of it? The purpose of it, as you're saying, was to allow them, to empower them with thinking critically, with the
yes.
skill, with the mindset of actually questioning authority, of thinking about issues like freedom and morality and truth.
That was very important, you said, question. So we were talking, and he said they have to know that they're not the defenders of a bankrupt order establishment. They are the challengers of it. They are the natural youthful skeptics. And I'm telling them that this is wonderful that your generation is the first one that's brave enough to say the establishment, like as the 60s used that term, is a fossilized, socialized, Soviet type of failed system, kind of like Eastern Europe. And you are the guys who are out on the streets, and you're going to be the ones that change it. And that's why everybody hated him. He said the university hates him for that because they all want to be known as left-wing revolutionaries. And he said they're not. They're just a bunch of people. And I said to him something to the effect, they're like Brezhnev on the dais at the May Day Report. You know, they're all fossilized, calcified apparat.
Right. They are the status quo.
Exactly. And he was trying to tell young people that and to get energetic and don't be apologetic. And when somebody says, oh, you're a right-wing fuddy-duddy, he said, no, you are a revolutionary, and these people are the establishment. and they've destroyed. They are destroying your life. And that was a good. That was a dangerous message. That's what
dangerous.
The left hated.
Yes, absolutely. Threatening the status quo, and the status quo was the power structure of the left. That's fascinating. Yeah. I mean, the guy. Honestly, I didn't know Charlie. I had met him only once, but he had such really amazing insight into what was going on.
Yeah, and I asked him that, and I said, "Where did you get all these insights?" He said, "Well, I went out to 2 years earlier. I spent the day with him. He asked me to speak at his headquarters at Turning Point in Phoenix. And I had lunch and dinner with him. I said, where did you get all these ideas? He goes, I had an advantage. I didn't go to college. I quit after a semester. So he said, I was never indoctrinated and I didn't like the people there. And so I never had college debt. And he said, I never had to have little letters after my name and everything. So he was a different type of person. And he had enormous energy. Gosh.
Enormous. Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it's going to be difficult. You know, I think it is a movement. There's no question about that. I think it remains to be seen if he's really replaceable. I'm not sure. I often am a skeptic about a lot of things, but it's not so easy to replace someone like that. Is he?
No, I don't think you can replace him. I don't. He was the most successful political organizer under 40 of either party. It's amazing his reach. He won. I went back and looked after he died. Donald Trump increased the vote between 18 and 39 by 7% in 2024 over 2020. But more importantly, the smaller vote, but key vote between 19 and 29 in the seven swing states, he increased it from 13 to 24%. And in Michigan, he broke even with Harris with a youth vote. And you added them all up, that radical flip of that one demographic made the difference in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, along with the Hispanic and Black votes. But that was a more crucial decider. And that was amazing that he did that by registering people and then before even the Republican MAGA people thought to embrace early voting, he really went after early voting and mail-in voting for young people. He was ahead of the game on all of that.
Absolutely. You know, one thing that he was also, I think, really hated by the left for is that he was an overt, explicit Christian.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
You know, I think it brings up another topic. I'm not a religious person. I wasn't raised in a religious home, but I was raised in a home that had Judeo-Christian values, to say an overused phrase, but it's really true. And I do think not everyone, it's just my own personal opinion, needs religion to have a morality anchor. I think people get it from a lot of places, particularly, though, their families. And religion is a very important part of society. And this has been a decades-long war on religion in America. It's been not just a sort of secularization or a separation of church and state. It's been an overt war, a ridiculing, a marginalization of people who are religious. This has started, I think, in the 60s, to my recollection, but it's been going on for decades. And it's very effective. There are there's a significant percentage increase in people with no religious affiliation today, but it's much more it's much larger in young people, in Gen Zs, and people who are under
Absolutely.
30 than it is in people who are over 60, to the point of maybe 2 to 3 times the percent of those age groups have no religious affiliation. What is that really? Is that a cause of what's going on here with the violence and the sort of moral confusion of young people today?
Yeah, I do think it is. And I think it has some collateral damage that we don't fully digest. If you believe that human nature is malleable, in other words, if you're religious, you believe that you're born into God's image and you have particular traits And religion helps you resist evil and temptation and your appetites of the body, so you preserve your soul for a transcendent experience, then you accept that human nature is sort of predictable and finite. It's just there. It can't be changed. You can ameliorate the worst. You can do certain things. But if you don't believe in that, and you are a humanist with a capital H, then you think that your God on earth, heaven on earth, that's your goal. And you can affect human nature. So you need a bigger government. You need all of these different therapeutic, you need a huge Department of Education. You go in and you can say, you know, we can have all of critical race theory, critical legal theory, critical this health theory, critical every theory. And we can, if you give us enough money and enough power, we can change human nature so that we're not greedy or we're not, and we don't have to have laws, you know. And critical legal theory is basically, well, if you go in and steal candy bars, it's not a crime because the theft of things like candy bars under $950 were just, those laws were made by wealthy white people because they don't steal candy bars. So they don't need candy bars. So they made all of these constructs rather than the laws reflect human nature. And human nature is pretty violent if you don't have laws against theft. But they believe that if you remove all of these things, and you then you can form human nature in a new Soviet man type of thing, then the only thing they need is power and money to do that. They want to control. That's why you see the same thing with the trans movement that wants the school district or the young 13-year-old to have the decision-making whether to remove your sexual organs or to take, you know, the parents shouldn't have any rule. That's why the trans movement wants to be able to have certain type of books in libraries without parental control. And it's the idea that the state, the atheistic agnostic state, should have power over families, communities, because they don't believe in that view of human nature. And they see them as danger because they're basically saying, sorry, progressives, we are imprinted in the image of God from when we're born. And we know from years of civilizational experience what man is capable of without civilization. He is a savage. Without religion to soften his rough edges, he will kill, rape, destroy things. He is not born perfect. He's not Rousseau. You know, everybody's born and changed and free. I mean, they were all nice and then society put them in chains. So it's a very, that's one of the reasons that they hate religion, because it says it's an individual, the individual knows right and wrong without the state telling them, and laws should reflect this innate nature of human nature, natural law, and whether you like it or not. And the founders were not all Christian and as we would define it, but they were deist, and they did believe as deist that the idea that people believed in God was very necessary, mm-hmm. because it was a moderator of human behavior, and it gave everybody a sense of transcendence, that you could say that these laws that we are inherited came from a divine source that was imprinted in us, and we know right and wrong innately. We don't need a PhD in psychology to tell us that theft can be okay if you steal less than, you know, $950. You know, I just listened to Jasmine Crockett, and she was saying that people who commit crimes are not criminals, because often they need money, or they need food and staples. And then I turned the station, and then there was just in San Ramon, California, about six cars went into a jewelry store, and they were followed by about 50 people dressed up, you know, disguise, mm-hmm. and they just went in and hopped over, and they destroyed the whole jewelry store and took out all the jewelry. This was just after she was lecturing the country that people who do that do it for food, when they were stealing, you know, expensive diamond necklaces and rings and stuff. But we all knew that was wrong. We don't need her or a professor of criminology at a university to tell us that they do us for a particular reason, and we can stop them by therapeutic counseling or something. And that's the danger that I see of atheism and agnosticism.
Thanks for listening to part one of my interview with Victor Davis Hanson. Stay tuned for part two.